Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Halber, 1945, Eyewitness Accounts from Hell's Cauldron, by Eberhard Baumgart. Translated by Eva Burke. Introduced by Roger Morehouse. Narrated by Bruce Mann. Introduction. Halber, 1945. Breakout to Defeat. The Battle of Halber is not one that holds much resonance for non-German audiences. As the last major engagement of World War II in Europe, it is conventionally merged with the wider Battle for Berlin, or folded into the general German collapse in the final weeks of the war. Yet it has a significant story to tell, a bloody, brutal story. Halber was the last great encirclement battle of the European War. The encirclement battle was a tactic that resulted when highly mobile forces found an overwhelming advantage in numbers or mobility vis-à-vis their opponents, and consequently it had featured right from the outset of the war, the first being the Battle of Tucholar Heath in the opening days of September 1939. Such engagements had then seen their hideous apogee in the weeks after the German invasion of the Soviet Union in the summer of 1941, when entire Soviet armies were destroyed in huge encirclements, such as at Minsk, Bryansk, and Kiev, and had duly featured once the tide had turned on the Eastern Front, with Red Army forces now encircling the Germans. The most infamous example, perhaps, being Operation Uranus, during the Battle of Stalingrad in November 1942. By 1945, then, encirclement tactics were routinely being deployed against understrength German units, and at Halber it was against those units that were desperately trying to defend the approaches to Berlin. Halber, therefore, was grimly symbolic of the war's changes of fortune. Halber itself is a small town, not far from the picturesque lakeland of the Spree Forest, southeast of Berlin. But in the spring of 1945, it stood at the heart of an area occupied by the German Ninth Army, under the command of General Theodor Busser. Having already been mauled in the Battle of Zillow Heights, to the east of Berlin earlier that month, Busser's men now found themselves in the eye of a new Soviet storm, caught between the jaws of two approaching Red Army fronts, with Marshal Georgi Zhukov's 1st Belorussian Front approaching from the northeast, and Marshal Ivan Konev's 1st Ukrainian Front circling to their rear, heading northwest towards the German capital. Their orders were to attempt to break out westward to join up with the German 12th Army under General Walter Wenck, which was fighting the Americans to the southwest of Berlin. It was a task that was easier said than done. Busser's forces had already been eviscerated, and though they contained a number of SS detachments, including the 9th SS Panzer Corps, there were also some much less fearsome units present, some comprising of Dragoon Luftwaffe ground crews and the old men and boys of the Volkssturm, which, though touted as a fearsome levée en masse, was in reality little more than a Hitlerite dad's army. Busser could field only around 80,000 men to face a battle-hardened Red Army force more than three times that size. The clash that ensued matched any of the European war for brutality. As Busser's forces inched westward, using those armoured SS spearheads as a vanguard, they had to maintain a fighting retreat at their rear to fend off Zhukov's men in the east. Three breakouts were attempted, all of which were contained by the Soviets, with heavy losses on both sides. For those in the centre of the cauldron, life was little easier, as they endured constant air and artillery attack. As one regimental commander later recalled, the shelling was so intense that he could barely raise his head. "All I could do was lie under a tank with my adjutant and look at the map." In this way, German forces would be contained and systematically reduced. Barely 20,000 men escaped the Halber cauldron, making their way in dribs and drabs through Soviet lines to join up with Wenck's 12th Army, which would, in time, surrender to the Americans. The remainder were either captured by the Soviets or killed. Among the former, there were some significant names, including Obergruppenführer Matthias Kleinheisterkamp, commander of the 9th SS Panzer Corps, and the thoroughly odious Obergruppenführer Friedrich Jeckeln, who, as commander of one of the infamous Einsatzgruppen, had been responsible for the cold-blooded murder of over 100,000 Jews earlier in the war. Kleinheisterkamp is thought to have committed suicide. Jeckeln would be hanged for his crimes. One who survived the carnage was Colonel Hans von Luck, whose capture brought to end a remarkable military career which had spanned Poland in 1939, France in 1940, Operation Barbarossa, North Africa, and Normandy. Some 30,000 German soldiers did not survive Halba, a figure broadly comparable in scale to the entire Allied death toll in the Battle for Normandy of 1944. In addition, an estimated 20,000 Soviet soldiers were killed, as well as around 10,000 civilian dead. Halba, clearly, was no sideshow. This collection of first-hand accounts tells the story of the battle and its aftermath from the German perspective. It is an eclectic mix containing the recollections of ordinary soldiers, from enlisted men to senior officers, and civilians, as well as SS men, men of the Panzer divisions, even the former mayor of Halba himself. It brings to life the grim realities of this most one-sided engagement, and contains numerous harrowing vignettes highlighting the ever-present threat of the brutal vengeance of the Soviets, the Red Army's material superiority, and the desperation just to escape the slaughter. Interestingly, some of the accounts presented here make reference to so-called Seydlitz troops, German POWs who had been turned by the Soviets and were now sent behind German lines to sow disinformation and chaos. In truth, Seydlitz troops, which were named after a German POW of the Soviets, General Walter von Seydlitz-Kurbach, were a figment of the fevered German imagination of 1945. Though Seydlitz was a prominent mouthpiece for Red Army propaganda aimed at German soldiers, such troops were never given the operational go-ahead by Stalin, and there is no evidence beyond the anecdotal that they ever fought. It is perhaps testament to the desperation that many German soldiers and civilians felt in the maelstrom of war that resulted in Halba that so many of them appeared to have believed in such a chimera. Aside from the vicarious, visceral thrill of reading such accounts, one must bear in mind that they have a purpose. The Battle of Halba scarcely registers with most readers, even those rather well-versed in the intricacies of World War II in Europe. In addition, most of those who write the histories that we read regrettably lack the language skills necessary to access new material and original sources. Consequently, events like the Battle of Halba struggle to penetrate the established narrative and so continue to languish in comparative obscurity, until a volume such as this one presents an opportunity for change, for a shift, however modest, in the story. This is to be welcomed. However difficult the subject matter, however discomforting the stories portrayed, it is only through bringing such material to a wider public that progress is made towards a more comprehensive understanding of history. For all that, however, what comes across most strongly is the sense of human tragedy in evidence on these pages. The rapes, the murdered prisoners, the wanton cruelty. The spectacle of the forces of two hideous totalitarian regimes fighting to the death, with no quarter given or expected, just as no quarter had been given or expected when the Germans had been supremely dominant some 3 years earlier, is one that should give us all pause, and should encourage us to cherish the fact that we live in more peaceful times. Roger Morehouse. Translator's Note. The bulk of this book consists of memories or diary notes written by eyewitnesses of the battles in and around Halba in 1945, during the campaign that saw the downfall of Berlin. As such, these first-hand accounts are written in different registers, as the authors vary in age and background. Some are military personnel, from high-ranking SS men to ordinary Lancer. Some are bystanders, ordinary civilian men and women. Others are landowners and farmers. Often we hear the voice of the town mayor. The text, though replete with army talk that lays bare a lack of leadership and absence of strategic thinking, is overlaid with a vocabulary primarily conveying pain, disappointment, and defeat. Out-of-touch or vaguely worded orders handed down by the Nazi leadership reflect the total collapse of their war, which is echoed by troops being confused, indecisive, and ignorant as to what to do, when, and where. The lack of maps on the German side is felt in unclear, often conflicting directions given and received. The tone and language used by the Nazi regime to have their people and armed forces believe in victory, yet in the end causing death and destruction in their own midst, reminds one instinctively of that used by the Nazi regime in its propaganda and extermination drives against minorities. Purposely devious, intentionally misleading, deliberately hiding behind language intended to keep victims in the dark and perpetrators firmly believing in a distorted reality. There was a collapse of language, which, with heavy irony, then played itself out to the detriment of the Nazi regime's own people. I decided not to focus on consistency of tenses, nor did I elaborate on geographical references made by the authors, so as to offer to the reader an authentic sense of time suspended and a blurred recollection of space. Repetitions, various chroniclers recall the same event more than once, have not been edited out. The intention here is to suggest that while recollections of time and space were hazy, the sense of trauma was prevalent and true. The last part of the book consists of some of the compiler's own thoughts in the aftermath of the Battle of Halba, specifically with reference to how and when those killed were buried and what happened to the survivors. What was the role the Soviet leadership played with respect to the war cemeteries and the camps they erected for their prisoners of war? These were often referred to as Schweigelager, silence camps, because the inmates were not permitted to have contact with the outside world. Here, it wasn't the disintegration or collapse of language that governed communication, but rather its total absence. This silence deliberately concealed the Soviet powers' inhumane, cruel, torturous, and murderous treatment of prisoners, and the atrocious conditions they were kept in. The compiler makes reference to that. This silence also obliterated any information about the prisoners. What had been their military career? What had been their involvement on the Eastern Front? Here, too, the compiler often fills in the vacuum, albeit rather too selectively, leaving the dark side of the Wehrmacht's activities blank, and instead highlighting his intense dislike of communist ideologies. I omitted the X which the compiler and author inserted before a contributor's wartime Wehrmacht or SS title, as these men were never removed from their position nor absolved of their actions. Thus, they appear as Hauptsturmführer and not ex-Hauptsturmführer. Eva Burke. The Eyewitness Accounts. Dear visitor, when you come to Halba, consider this. You are at the site of the largest burial ground in all of modern Germany's history. Remember the fallen. Consider that they were not only soldiers, but women and children too, who died during their so-called liberation by the Soviets. Geography is a law which governs history. Attributed to Cervantes. This quote came true with the tragic and bloody destruction of the Ninth Army, an army which retreated to the southwest over the Berlin to Frankfurt/Oder highway with its left flank completely destroyed, but whose general, Theodor Busse, showed himself utterly inflexible when it came to strategy. Intent on refusing either to be pushed or ordered back into an encircled Berlin under any circumstances, he also had no wish to capitulate and offer up his army to the Soviets. His only other option, then, was to pass round Berlin to the southwest, and, by reaching the safety of the Elbe River, link up with Walter Wenck's 12th Army. Slipping through tight gaps in a neck of land bounded by a chain of lakes south of the highway, the units that were forced back would find themselves in a large, heavily forested region, a cauldron, with its southern edge bordering on the impenetrable Spreewald and traversed by the Dahme River. The only breakout route led through a bottleneck-shaped piece of countryside with no lakes. The route through Halber. Those managing to traverse this corridor ended up in a dense forest, enclosed on all sides, with its southern border made up by the Barut glacial valley, which points west and only west. Two Reichsautobahnen, four Reichsstraßen, and the same number of rail lines cut through this crescent-shaped woodland from north to south, offering those surrounding the pocket ideal lines of advance. The Soviet chief of staff had done his homework, and, having studied the geography of this area in depth, was in full control, and able to exercise command on both a strategic and tactical level. Soviet resources extended, of course, to the German communist scouts operating undercover, who were well equipped to put themselves to good use. It so happened that when it came to cartography, the encircled German troops were groping in the dark, often quite literally. Not a single officer in the lower ranks of the army reported having had any maps to hand. Even the commander of the 30th of January SS Division, charged with providing cover to the 9th Army retreating from the Halber Cauldron, was completely out of his depth and unaware of what was going on. Only one small unit reports that it had been fortunate enough to acquire a rambler's map of the area, which outlined an escape route along a trail penetrating the forest, and then to the safety of the opposite bank of the Elbe. The Halber bottleneck became a fateful pit, swallowing up tens of thousands of men. Opposing forces in the Battle of Halber. Red Army, 45 rifle divisions, 13 tank/armored brigades, 1 artillery division. Wehrmacht, 11 infantry divisions, 2 motorized divisions, 1 tank division. At the beginning of the Battle of Berlin, the 16th of April 1945, German divisions were reduced to an average combat force of 5,000 soldiers, and the above matchup shows the vast, indeed fourfold, Russian superiority in available units, a ratio of 45-11 infantry divisions. Additionally, the German forces would lose much of their heavy armour in the course of their retreat and were running dangerously low on fuel and lubricants. The troops' morale had dropped precipitously, and wounded and sick German bodies heaped on the ground could barely be attended to. A 50% casualty rate was registered. Also, fueled by Nazi propaganda, the Germans were terrified of what would happen if Berlin fell into Soviet hands. Contrasting the dismal picture on the German side, the Soviet situation was impressive. With Soviet troops highly motivated, tightly organized, and well equipped with heavy weapons of all sizes, their thrusts were keenly coordinated. In addition, they had a highly efficient system in place for recovering their wounded. If this were not enough, the 1st Ukrainian Front was well informed about the local geography, and its men were able to construct elaborate ambush positions along the German line of retreat that would enable them to inflict heavy casualties. Wenck's 12th Army was thinly strung out to the west, with sometimes only a handful of soldiers holding a kilometre of the front line. Red Army Psychological Warfare, Willy Harnacker, ex-mayor of Halba. The following steps were taken to encourage troops of the Ninth Army to capitulate. First Ukrainian Front dropped some 4 million propaganda flyers. Hundreds of loudspeakers positioned just behind the front line blared out invitations to surrender. Turncoat prisoners of war working for the Red Army against their former comrades were often sent back to the German side to incite and agitate. Specially trained civilians from the battle zone, men and women, were sent to infiltrate German positions. A total of 861 prisoners were sent to the German side. Some 477 of these went back to the Russians, taking with them 8,816 defectors. So-called Seydlitz units, supposedly operating on behalf of the National Committee for a Free Germany, were present, camouflaged in Wehrmacht uniforms. After some initial breakouts, the situation of the Ninth Army turned catastrophic. Effectively deprived of any leeway to act, it possessed only the barest minimum of ammunition for its heavy weapons and had severe shortages of fuel for its tanks and trucks. Troops were reduced to close-quarter fighting with little more than small arms. A thinly spread line of tanks and assault guns with a pathetic number of shells provided the backbone of the German operations, and were thus far more exposed to the ferocious enemy fire. Nearly all of them were destroyed. The Soviet troops, so close to victory, were highly motivated. The other side of the coin was, however, the fact that not a single one of them wished to die a hero's death. Later German eyewitness accounts comment on how carefully Soviet infantry behaved on the raging battlefield, as they knew full well that, whichever way this attack ended, Fritz wasn't going to slip through their fingers. Deafening noises reach Halba. Willy Harnacker, ex-mayor of Halba. In the summer of 1944, the Allies embarked on their invasion of the Atlantic coast. While the war was already lost, many people refused to believe this to be true, or put on a show of confidence to calm each other down. In Halba, as in the Reich as a whole, a provisional militia, the Volkssturm, was formed from October 1944, with all men between the ages of 16 and 60 called up to register at the local town hall. I was one of those waiting in line. The Red Army reached the banks of the Oder early in 1945. The Volkssturm was sworn in. We were trained in how to operate a Panzerfaust, and once I even got the chance to fire one. This, I asked myself incredulously, holding the launch tube in my hand, is supposed to do the trick and hold off the Soviets. One of our units was charged to construct defensive positions in Halba. We dug foxholes and laid anti-tank defences all around the city. Halba itself had to face its own challenge, housing a stream of refugees, with some 1,000 passing through every night. Many of them arrived with carts brimming over with whatever possessions these people had managed to gather before fleeing their homes. Others just pulled along a sparsely filled hand wagon. Each morning they were ordered to move on and make way for the next batch. Few of them had a destination in mind. West was the single word etched in their consciousness. Understandably, ever since January 1945, the population had been feeling increasingly worried. With the daily din of shelling and explosions near the Oder growing to a crescendo, the question on everyone's lips was, what'll happen to us? Where should we flee to? Then, one day, our two French workers said to me in broken German, "Boss, you getting two large crates, you putting in all valuables, you then bury it." They were, truth be told, better informed than we had realized. It is thanks to them that we managed to salvage enough to keep us going for a while after the war. Some horse dealers, including myself, had considered setting off westwards. Otto Buchwald, a bar owner and also a trader in horses like me, planned to go along with the retreating troops by using the forest path leading to Barut. At the time, none of us knew that the Red Army had occupied Barut, Wunsdorf, and Zossen, and that in actual fact we were surrounded. I had covered two carts with a tarpaulin, and was intending to harness a horse to one of them for my parents. For one reason or another, we kept delaying our departure, and, fortunately for us, this turned out to be the right decision. It transpired that our friends, the Paulitz family, would pay dearly for their flight. While they managed to travel without any hassle from the Buchwald's place to the Autobahn, they then realized too late that it had already fallen into the hands of the Red Army. The loss of civilian life this entailed was horrendous. Frau Buchwald was able to escape to Barut and then return several weeks later, but Herr Buchwald and the Paulitz family fled to Halba, with Frau Paulitz being shot dead en route. Herr Buchwald, heavily wounded, sought refuge in his cellar, but his wagon and his animals were gone. Like my predecessor Sheba, I tried to ensure that the Volkssturm stored their weapons in a stable on the lower level of the town hall. In truth, I had no authority to give any such commands, but by then everyone had realized that it was sheer folly to put up any resistance. I kept turning over and over in my mind what I was meant to do. Should I attempt to break away at some point, somehow? Surely I would be able to return once all had calmed down. Before too long, I had packed my rucksack, stuffed it with food, and set off. As I passed Lerpnerstrasse near Mastrangelo's, a woman stopped to ask me where I was headed. When I admitted that indeed I had no idea, she offered to help. "Why don't you stay the night? Perhaps it won't be as bad as you fear." I decided to do just that, never dreaming that this particular night would determine my fate. I decided to stay put and not flee. Seydlitz Troops, Hauptsturmführer Hohengassner, SS Anti-Aircraft Division 550. On the 25th of April 1945, our squad was redistributed to the area of Hermsdorf Four-Stamped Hammer. It was at the time when the enemy put the lid on the Halber cauldron. We were completely encircled. The enemy hammered us with an irresistible ferocity, deploying supporters of the National Committee for a Free Germany, who were charged to cause confusion amongst German troops. This is when we first came across Seydlitz troops and realized what their intentions were. Men in fake officers' uniforms began to appear more and more frequently, mingling amongst our troops and issuing what struck us as the most impossible orders, which they presented to us as commands from higher up. These fabricated instructions had a devastating impact. They varied in content and complemented each other. Units were not permitted to retreat. They were to gather and convene at assembly points. It was their duty to blow up guns, tanks, and other vehicles. Non-compliance with the orders would result in unit leaders being shot immediately on the spot. One thing these turncoats had in common was that none seemed to cover their heads. They all wore a white armband and sported new uniforms on which were pinned numerous decorations. Chaos erupted close to the Dahme River. Units thrust forwards from all directions towards its only bridge. Some intended to escape to Wendisch Buchholt, others to Halber. Amid the turmoil, members of the National Committee for a Free Germany issued conflicting orders, as described above. What followed was total mayhem. Officers took their own lives, and men became hysterical, running through the open space like hounded prey. Wounded bodies piled up high on the roadside. Indiscriminate Russian fire caused heavy casualties on our side, and there was no resistance to speak of. Each one of us was his own commander. The 28th of April 1945, 2200 hours. Excerpt from the diary of Oberscharführer Horst Wojcinek, artillery observer with 32nd SS Division, the 30th of January. In the early hours of the 28th of April, we were redeployed. To join our division in the pocket of Halber, we first had...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?